or a Bloody Mary. I wanted something hard to drink, the way a starving lion wanted red meat. I tried to muster my courage. No going back now. I had to do this for Beverly and Henry, for Oscar and Dina, for Teddy, who was giving up so much to stay here with me. Far more than he let on. For Jonah, I thought. For you, my sweet love. I'll do this for you. And though I felt utterly worthless, and the task in front of me seemed impossible, I dared to add myself to the roster. For me, too, to live. Teddy, I called to him in a tiny voice. He came awake at once, sitting up and glancing around until he saw me, standing in the middle of the kitchen, clutching my elbows. My skin already felt itchy.
"It's okay, Case,"
he said, rubbing the sleep from his eyes and nodding.
"I'm right here."
Chapter 6. Theo. It didn't take long for the addiction to torture her. She had no real food in the house. After leaving my hotel the night before, I'd bought a bunch of healthy foods and bottles of water at a 24-hour grocery store. Mid-morning of the first day, I found Dirty Dancing on a cable channel and coaxed Casey to the couch to watch. She had a thing for 80s movies. She sipped water as the movie played, but didn't eat. Her leg bounced, and she constantly wrung her hands together. By afternoon, watching movies was abandoned. She paced her small living room, her face dampened with sweat, her eyes wild. By early evening, she alternated cursing me out with begging for a drink. Soon, dry heaving was added to the rotation. Rage, plead, wretch. I stayed out of her way. I gritted my teeth through her tearful begging. I held her hair until she regained the strength to start the cycle again. Rage, plead, wretch. Occasionally, she fell into short, exhausted sleeps that gave me 10 or 15 minutes to catch my breath. They didn't give her anything. She woke up more angry, more desperate, more wretched. Thirstier. By midnight, she was in free-falling anxiety. There were short fits of uncontrollable tears as she paced. She never stopped pacing, pulling at her hair and glancing around with frantic eyes, as if she'd lost something precious. I watched helplessly, unable to do more than block the front door and coax her to drink water. Sometimes she clawed and hit me. Sometimes she curled limp into my arms, her body trembling, as if she were freezing to death. It was a long night. The second day dawned, and we were already exhausted. Withdrawal, however, was just getting warmed up. Day 2 nearly killed her. And it nearly broke me, too. By afternoon, I wanted to call it quits, resign, and take her to a professional. "No, Teddy," she begged. Her face was blotchy from crying, her clothes drenched in sweat, her voice hoarse from screaming at me. "Don't give me to strangers. Please, I can do this. I can. I will." What could I say? If she could, I could. I held her close until she pushed away to pace more, to vomit the water I'd managed to get her to drink into the kitchen sink. I didn't think it could get any worse. Then delusional tremors, the DTs, started. Casey's hands shook as if she'd been doused in ice water, and it scared me to the bone. I answered a knock on the door in the late morning to an African-American woman in jeans, an orange shirt, and wielding a baseball bat. She jumped back when I opened the door and readied her bat for a swing. Turned out she was a nurse who lived next door. She heard Casey screaming and thought something criminal was happening. I let her in, and she helped me check Casey's vitals. Her pulse was fast, but not too fast. She wasn't hallucinating. She wasn't convulsing beyond tremors. The nurse, Yvonne, okayed me to keep her home unless it all escalated, and I felt a little calmer after she left. The ordeal still tore at my goddamn heart, but I was less terrified. We spent the second night on the living room floor. It must have been 80 degrees in that small house with no air conditioning, yet Casey bundled herself in blankets, crying at how cold she was. She didn't sleep more than a handful of minutes. I didn't sleep at all. Day 3. Casey burst out of her blanket cocoon and sat up, ramrod straight, as if she'd remembered what she'd lost and knew where to find it. She kicked her legs free. Her t-shirt stuck to her skin with sweat, all down her back to darken the waistband of her sweatpants. When she glanced at me, her eyes had a clarity I hadn't seen in days. The terrible fever had finally broken, and hope rose in me. This fucking nightmare was almost over. "How do you feel?" I asked. "Hot," she said in a croak. "It's so hot in here." She scrambled off the floor and hurried to the bathroom, stripping off her shirt. Her tattoos were dark blotches against her pale skin. I followed. "What, you don't trust me alone?" she said, turning on the shower, then stripping off her sweatpants, leaving her in nothing but her underwear. "No." I averted my eyes from her almost naked body and busied myself getting a clean towel from underneath the sink. Casey stepped under the stream of water and shivered. "Cold," she murmured through clenched teeth. "It's like rain. Cold rain." The water fell over her tangled hair and pale, goose-fleshed skin. Her face crumpled, and her hands clutched her chest between her bare breasts, over her heart. "Here it comes," I thought. "The worst, the lowest, the most excruciating, the demon king of pain, what I was too fucking scared to face myself."
"The rain,"
Casey whispered, the water dripping off her lips and chin.
"Up at the basin. I danced for him in the cold rain. I danced for him."
She slowly slid down the tiles, collapsing to the shower floor. Pulling her knees to her chest, she rocked back and forth under the water. Great howling wails filled the small stall. I stood frozen a moment, my chest tightened, my own grief trying to well up in an echo of hers. I shut off the water, took a towel, and bent into the shower to wrap it around her, before lifting her up. She felt like nothing in my arms, yet she clung to me hard as I carried her into the bedroom and laid her down on the bed. I lifted Jonah's glass orb out of the way and set it on its stand on a near-empty bookshelf. "I'm not going to let you down, bro," I vowed, as I set it down and curled up next to Casey. I wrapped my arms around her, and she clung to me. She cried forever, hours maybe. I lost track of time, but just held her, stroked her wet, tangled hair, and rocked her gently.
"Is it over?"
she said. "Almost. You can sleep." I tucked her blankets tighter around her, watching as her breathing deepened. Her chest rose and fell in long, even waves. Even though her face was splotchy red and her closed eyes puffy, the tense edges of her expression had relaxed. I exhaled from my bones, eased off the bed, and left her to sleep. Leaving the bedroom door ajar, I staggered down the arrow straight hallway to the couch. I could hardly keep my eyes open. Every muscle howled in protest as I sank into the ratty cushions. "Holy shit," I muttered, and then I was gone, but only for a few hours. I shot awake in the deepest part of the night. Creeping into the bedroom, I found Casey still sleeping on, deeply and peacefully. And I knew then that she'd be okay. She'd fought the hardest battle and come out the other side. I lay back on the couch, covered my eyes with the arm, and let out another breath, this one loose and shaky. "That was a close call, bro," I told Jonah. "But she made it. She fucking made it. You'd be so proud of her." My thoughts began to scatter like beads of oil over water as sleep took me again. Proud of Casey. She loves you so much. Loves you.
Chapter 7. Casey. I woke up feeling as if I'd been running for miles and miles, and months and months, chased by a monster that wanted to drown me. And now it was over. I'd won. I lay on my back, my bones sinking into the mattress. Had it always felt this soft? A deep sigh gusted out of me, and I closed my eyes against the too bright light filling the window of my bedroom. The last few days, 3, 4, were like some awful, twisted nightmare. I remembered it in bits and pieces, sweat-soaked and agonizing. My body felt wrung out, squeezed dry, and I suspected that if I tried to talk, my voice would be hoarse from screaming. Teddy. I'd screamed at Teddy. He had run from the monster with me, catching me when I stumbled and helping me keep my feet. I fell down 100 times, but without him, I don't know that I would have gotten back up again. And last night, I'd been on the verge of shattering into 1,000,000 pieces until I felt Theo's arms around me, holding me together. I remembered the sound of his strong heart beating in my ear, and how afraid I was until he said, "I'm here." And then I could sleep. I climbed out of bed, my arms and legs full of lead, my head thudding in time with my pulse. In the living room, Theo lay on the couch, eyes closed. He was too big for my ratty old couch. One arm and one leg were dangling. But he lay deep asleep, despite the shaft of sunlight slanting across him. It felt a little intrusive, watching him sleep. But I couldn't help it. I'd been alone for so long, and Theo had materialized out of thin air on Barone Street all those nights ago. Profound gratitude that he was there, lying on my too small couch, brought tears to my eyes. I brushed them away and felt the puffy skin. My hair fell around my shoulders in a rat's nest, and I stunk badly. I retreated to my small bathroom. A small cry caught in my throat at the reflection in the mirror. I looked as if I'd been punched in both eyes and now had mild shiners. I touched the mess of my hair and wondered if I might have to cut it off. But it's over, I told my pathetic reflection. The fluorescent light caught the glint in my eyes that was dimmed, but not snuffed. You did it. And it's over. Not quite. A small voice warned that I'd have to fight against the urge to drink for the rest of my life. But for the first time in a long time, I thought I had a chance. I shuddered as the shower loosened my stiff, aching limbs. My skin felt paper thin, my muscles weak. Dried off, I put on a fresh pair of sweatpants and the oldest, softest t-shirt I owned. I dragged a brush through my hair until my arm protested, then gave myself one last look in the bathroom mirror. Dark circles, sallow skin, bloodshot eyes. A definite improvement. Theo was still asleep as I slipped past the living room to the kitchen. A glance at the stove clock said it was after 11 a.m. I began making coffee as quietly as I could, but as I flicked on the faucet, he stirred and sat up, scratching his face and blinking.
Morning,
he said. Morning. My voice felt like sandpaper against my throat. Theo watched me closely.
How are you feeling?
I forced my own small smile. Like a truck hit me, threw it in reverse, and backed over me to finish the job. As he stood up and stretched, I reached in a cabinet for a canister of coffee. While my mind reached into the blurry mess of the last few days, trying to sort the memories out. My hands shook as I struggled to separate one coffee filter from the stack.
Here, let me.
Theo got up and joined me in the kitchen. I'm weak as hell, I said, my cheeks burning with shame. I wore myself out taking the shower and wrestling with my hair.
But you did it.
I looked up at him. He practically filled my entire kitchen, and yet I still couldn't believe he was here. Solid and real. Not a figment of my alcohol-drowned imagination.
Sit,
he said, his large hand gentle on my shoulder.
I got this.
I shuffled out of the kitchen and fell into the easy chair facing the couch. My body hugged around a pillow while Theo moved around my kitchen like he lived here. At the risk of sounding like an idiot, when did you arrive in New Orleans?
5 days ago,
Theo said. I shook my head, incredulous. 5 days? And they're all a blur. I looked over at him. How did you know where to find me?
The bartender from Le Chacal called me,
Theo said, pouring water into the coffee maker.
Mike. Big E. He overheard you talking tattoos with some guy, and you kept repeating the name Teddy.
And you dropped everything and flew halfway across the country. The first scent of brewing coffee curled around the air. I hugged the pillow tighter as Theo came to sit on the couch. I'm sorry, I whispered.
Don't,
he said, waving his hand. I have to, I said, wiping my eyes on the back of my hand. I have so much to be sorry for. Need to start somewhere.
Start later,
Theo said.
Right now, you should try to eat something. I wasn't able to get more than a few cups of water in you all this time, which is why you feel weak. Is there a place around here you like?
Rooney's Cafe. It's a diner about a 3-block walk from here. I stumbled in a couple of times when the booze made me crave greasy food.
I'll get us something from there,
he said, heading back to the kitchen.
You mind if I take a quick shower first?
No, go ahead. I heard the watery bubble of coffee being poured into a cup. Then Theo pressed the mug into my hand. I sipped and immediately set it down. Too hot. Too strong.
too much. Everything was too much, as if my body was made of rice paper, inside and out. Theo emerged from the shower 10 minutes later, looking darkly handsome in a blue t-shirt, jeans, and boots.
What do you want to eat?
I tried to think of the least offensive food, something easy to chew and swallow. Oatmeal would be great, thanks. He started for the door, then stopped.
You got a house phone? For emergencies?
No, just my cell. My voice trailed off as a vague memory swam up at me. I sank into the chair under its weight. Oh my God.
You had a cell.
Theo said with a wry twist to his lips. Teddy, I'm so sorry. He cut me off again.
I'll leave you my phone.
What for?
I don't know. In case you feel really sick.
He shrugged, grinned.
Or maybe play some Fruit Ninja.
I smiled. You think of everything. In the quiet house, I took tiny sips of coffee and played one game of solitaire before opening Theo's contacts. The sheer amount of women's names, mostly just first names, made me roll my eyes with a small laugh. But the laugh died out when my random scrolling landed on Dina. Then Oscar. The Fletcher's home number. Tanya, Jonah's assistant. Emmy, the curator at the Galleria. And Jonah. My thumb shook as it hovered over the call button. Would I hear his old voicemail message? Or did the Fletchers have it disconnected? Don't. You're barely hanging on after last night. You got nothing in your stomach. You don't have a hand to hold. Don't do this. You're not strong enough yet. I hit call and slowly put the phone to my ear.
Hey, you've reached Jonah Fletcher.
My heart ripped in two as I remembered why I'd thrown away my old cell all those months ago.
Leave me a message and I'll call you back.
He sounded so healthy. No hitching breaths, no fatigue turning his voice to a whisper. I could leave a message and he'd call back in 5 minutes. He could walk through the front door, bickering with Theo, carrying takeout from Rooney's.
Have a good one.
I was still crying when Theo came back, bringing the scent of hash browns and eggs with him. He didn't ask any questions, only set up the takeout on my splintered wooden coffee table. A small container of oatmeal for me, and what looked to be like one of everything on the menu for himself. I called Jonah, I said, putting his cell phone on the table. His number, I mean. The voicemail message set me off again. It serves me right for snooping. I'm sorry about that. Theo's thick, dark brows furrowed.
No big deal.
I just want to stay honest, I said. It's not much, but I'm sorry.
Hey.
His tone was sharp and I looked up miserably.
I do it too,
he said, his voice now low and soft.
I call him all the time, just to hear his voice.
I couldn't help it, I said, wiping my eyes. I had to throw my old phone away because I was calling him dozens of times a day. Theo nodded.
I still talk about him in present tense.
Those simple words did more to lift my spirits than anything else. Almost more than Theo holding me together over the last few days. I wanted to confess everything to him. Why I left Vegas. Why I was drinking myself to oblivion. But he was tearing into the food.
Fuck, I'm hungry,
he said, digging around the bags. I'm sure you are, I said. I don't have much to eat around here. I was on a liquid diet. I glanced up at him. You had your work cut out for you. Theo shrugged.
What friends do,
he said, digging into a huge portion of biscuits and gravy. Yeah, they fly halfway across the country to wrestle a screaming, puking banshee for three.
Eat,
he said, jerking his chin at the oatmeal. I laughed a little, a rusty sound. If you insist. I picked at my oatmeal. My body felt like it had been turned inside out, then put back right side in, but with everything in the wrong place. I put the smallest amount of oatmeal on my tongue. It tasted like warm paste with cinnamon. I forced myself to eat half a dozen bites, then set it down to watch Theo devour the feast in front of him. I rested my cheek in my hand, half concealing my smile as he put away the biscuits and started in on a side of hash browns. Theo must have felt my eyes on him.
What?
It's good to see you again, I said. I'm sorry the circumstances are. He pointed the fork at me.
Stop apologizing.
It feels like I have a lot to apologize for. I plucked at my paper napkin. How's Beverly?
She's okay. As good as can be expected.
Is she upset with me?
She was worried about you. We all were.
I should have called her. I should have said something, but I started to offer an excuse, but swallowed it down. Like bitter bile. I owe her an apology, to say the least.
I called her yesterday. Told her you were under the weather, but getting better.
Thank you. He shrugged, wiped his mouth on a napkin, and took a sip of coffee. What about your dad? I asked, toying with my oatmeal.
He's thrown himself into his work. He was semi-retired, but he's been spending more time at the city hall trying to make himself useful. Fill the hours, I guess.
And how do you do it?
Do what?
Fill the hours.
Work, mostly. The shop's been really busy lately.
I dropped my spoon. But now you're here with me. Theo tossed down his napkin and looked at me with hard eyes.
Yeah, I am. And I'd do it again in a heartbeat, so stop stressing over it.
He smiled a little to soften his words.
You needed help, so I helped. Not a big deal.
It was a huge fucking deal, but I let it drop. Jesus, I don't even know what day of the week it is. I might be missing work, too.
It's Wednesday,
Theo said.
And I think you need to take some time off.
I think you're right. Can I borrow your phone? I called Rufus, the owner of Le Chacal, and told him I was too sick to play the next night. Sudden laryngitis. Thanks to my hoarse voice, he sounded only mildly irritated at the last-minute cancellation. And Rufus? I said, before we hung up.
Yeah?
Tell Big E I said thank you. He'll know what for. I called the other clubs, telling them I was sick and would let them know when I was able to come back. If I come back, I thought. I handed Theo's phone back to him. When do you need to get back to Vegas?
I was thinking I'd fly back Sunday night.
Theo said, cleaning up the remnants of our food.
Sound okay?
I nodded. Of course. Honestly, the thought of being alone scared the shit out of me. I'd only been fully sober, and not ravaged by withdrawals, for half a day. Theo was here for two more,
So I decided to allow myself those 2 days to figure my shit out. I was too tired. Too mentally and physically exhausted to do anything yet, anyway. Tomorrow I might be up to showing you around New Orleans, I said. Right now, I'm so tired. Do you want to watch a movie?
Sure. I don't know if you remember, but Dirty Dancing is making the rounds on cable. That's 80s, right?
I smiled. A classic. I'd love to give it another try. He turned on my small flat screen and found the movie on demand. I didn't even know I had cable, I said.
That means you've been paying your bills,
Theo said. Yeah, I guess I have, I said. Theo sat on the couch, arms along both sides of the back, legs spread out. I curled tight in the chair, but it wasn't comfortable. And that old longing to touch and be touched was fierce in me. My body felt small and fragile, and needing the protective embrace of another human being. I cursed myself for being so pathetic. Theo had seen me at my worst, hysterical and sick, naked and puking, and had held me through it all. I felt hesitant to ask for more. Or maybe it felt hard to ask now, because I was sober. I asked anyway. Teddy?
Yeah?
Do you mind if I sit with you? He looked over at me. Something gentle passed over his eyes, then melted down his features, softening all the hard edges.
If you want.
He scooted to one side, and I curled up beside him. Not touching him, but nearly. I could feel the warmth of his body and smell the clean scent of his skin. Right around the time Baby and Johnny were practicing the lift in the lake, my head began to droop, and my eyes kept falling shut.
Come here.
Theo put his arm around me. He sank lower into the cushions, making a pillow of his chest. His hand reached to pull the blanket from the back of the couch and drape it over my legs.
Sleep,
he said. I sighed, melted against him, and drifted away on the lake.
Chapter 8. Theo. The next morning, she emerged from her room looking a million times better than she had all week. Her color was back. Her hair brushed. It wasn't bleached anymore. She said she'd been letting the natural color grow out, a kind of honey blonde. I was too wasted to keep up with the peroxide, she said. She put down her onion bagel to examine a lock of hair. I haven't seen this color since I was 14. Kind of blah. Kind of fucking gorgeous, I thought. The strange color of her eyes, light blue iris ringed in darker blue, was more vibrant against the brass gold of her hair. I shrugged over my coffee cup. Looks good. Casey smiled and chatted on. How are Oscar and Dina? She asked.
Engaged.
She sat up straighter. Really? He finally popped the question?
Yep.
How did he propose?
He took her to Great Basin a few months ago. Not exactly a surprise, but it's his favorite place.
I think it's a great place.
Her eyes seemed to retreat, pulling inward. The gaze of someone falling back in time.
I think I blocked that entire camping trip to Great Basin from my mind. I had to. It was too perfect. The first time Jonah and I...
She glanced up through tears and sniffed a laugh.
Well, you know.
I kept my face expressionless. Yeah, I know.
It was the kicker, though, she said. the memory that finally pulled me out of the withdrawals. I wonder why. It was a powerful memory. Like you said, you'd blocked the entire trip out. Yesterday morning, you let it back in. Proverbial floodgates. She laughed a little. Literally and figuratively, I looked like I lost a boxing match. But better now, I said. It still hurts. Really fucking badly. But it's a different kind of hurt. It's cleaner, somehow. Like, I can cry if I need to, but I can stop if I need to, too. I didn't have that before. It's why I drank, I guess. To keep numb. So I wouldn't have to always be fighting back the pain. That was too exhausting. A short silence dropped between us. Do you want to get out of here? She asked suddenly. I've lived in this city for 6 months and still haven't seen it. If you're up for it. I think so. I feel better. And it doesn't seem right you came all this way just to sit in the house.
I wouldn't mind getting out.
Great. Casey slipped off the chair, still moving a little slowly, as if she were breakable. I'll get ready. We drove into the French Quarter and parked near Jefferson Square. Her arm linked in mine, Casey pointed out various landmarks, the St. Louis Cathedral, a museum, an art gallery. Every other minute, my eyes were drawn to her. She'd put on dark jeans and an oversized dark gray sweater that left one shoulder bare. She seemed to like that style. Her hair fell like brushed brass, and she'd put on some kind of perfume that made it hard to think. She was beautiful. Walking arm in arm with her, it was easy to pretend her bloodshot eyes, thin face, and the hoarseness in her voice were because she was getting over an illness. Just a bug that had knocked her out a little while. All was fine now. We were out for a walk. We were together. Rein it in, I told myself, before you do something stupid. It was hard to be subdued in this setting. New Orleans was alive in a different way than Vegas felt alive. My city was wide open and filled with lights. New Orleans held you tight in the past. City center was a maze of old buildings with wrought iron lattices and French fleur-de-lis. We walked past clubs and cafes, restaurants and bars. A bar on every block, a watering hole on every corner. Basically the worst part of town for recovering alcoholics to wander around in, Casey observed. You want to leave? I asked. She chewed her bottom lip for a moment. No, I want to go there. I followed her pointing finger to a tiny shop with beads and colored lights strung along the window. On the glass was a hand in white paint with an eye in the palm. Above the palm, red neon said, Palm and Tarot Readings. Below, it read, Love, Fate, Destiny. I frowned. A psychic? Just to check it out, she said. I used to love tarot cards when I was a teenager. And there's something about New Orleans, the Cajun history, the voodoo traditions. She jerked her shoulders up. I think it's neat. It was the first time she sounded a shade above sad since I'd been here. That was enough reason to let her tug me into the tiny shop. A bell jingled above the door as we stepped inside, and the scent of incense hit me hard. The dimly lit entry looked like the front foyer of a house, with a heavy purple curtain with gold fringe separating the shop from the residence. A small round table with four chairs stood to the right of the front door. An even smaller table displayed trays of beads, rough-cut crystals, and pieces of wood carved with runes. Old books lined the shelves,
and between the shelves hung dream catchers, straw voodoo dolls, and colorful drawings of sugar skulls, large laughing faces, some wearing top hats and smoking, some wearing wedding dresses with straw hair and sewn lips. Palm readings and psychic powers sounded like bullshit to me, but I liked the vibe of the place anyway.
"Isn't this cool?" Casey said, letting go of my arm to trail her fingers over the purple crystals in their slot on the tray.
The heavy curtain was drawn aside, and the owner of the shop stepped out. I'd half expected a woman in a turban with a crystal ball under her arm, or maybe that googly-eyed professor from the Harry Potter movies. This woman was neither a cliché gypsy nor a crazy-haired weirdo. She looked in her mid-40s, with long cornrows that ended in colorful beads that clacked with every movement. Her clothes were billowy silk, but modern. Thick gold hoops dangled from her ears.
"Welcome," she said in a smooth voice. "My name is Olivia. You have come for a reading?"
"We are just looking," Casey said. "You have a beautiful shop."
Olivia smiled and swept across the room to the small table.
"That is kind of you to say, but that is not why you stepped inside, no?"
It was an effort not to roll my eyes. I knew the opener of a sales pitch when I heard one.
"Come, sit."
Olivia gestured to the two empty chairs at her table and pulled out a deck of oversized cards from a pocket in her robes.
"You are curious, yes? Maybe a little intrigued?"
"Not really," I said, at the exact same time Casey said,
"Yes, a little."
Casey and Olivia laughed, and the fortune teller tapped long, red-painted nails on the stack of cards.
"A full reading is $20. 3-card draw is $10. 1 card is only $5. A small taste of what I offer."
"The 1-card reading doesn't sound too bad," Casey said.
"$5 each. That is cheap, yes, for guidance and wisdom from the other side."
The way Olivia's voice wrapped reverently around "the other side" told me it was a real place to her. I felt Casey's hand slip into mine. Then she was tugging me toward the table.
"One card, Teddy. It'll be fun."
Feeling like an idiot, I sat beside Casey at the too small table while Olivia shuffled her deck. The backs were black with gold edging. Once shuffled to her liking, she fanned them out on the table.
"These cards tell the future?" I asked dubiously.
"A full reading tells us where you have been, where you are, and where you're going," Olivia said. "One card gives us a snapshot of the present. By understanding where you are now, you are able to see more clearly what lies ahead. Clarity is the goal. Wipe away the fog of uncertainty. Sometimes that is all it takes to bring a little relief to a troubled soul."
She said these last words to Casey, and Casey nodded hopefully.
"So," Olivia said, beaming, "who is going first?"
"He is," Casey said.
"I'm not going at all," I said. "This is your deal."
Olivia laughed heartily as Casey jostled my arm.
"Come on, Teddy. What have you got to lose?"
I looked over at Casey, at her eyes punching bright and blue through the dim shop. I huffed a sigh of defeat.
"Fine, okay."
Those damn eyes. Olivia trailed her fingers over the card.
"Choose one and lay it down in front of you."
Figuring most people picked cards from the middle, and Olivia probably counted on that, I chose from the far right of the deck. I flipped over a card, revealing a sketch of a man hanging upside down by 1 foot from the limbs of a T-shaped tree.
"The Hanged Man," Olivia said, scooping the cards back into a neat stack, leaving my card on the table in front of me. This does not surprise me. I suppressed another eye roll. Beside me, Casey leaned forward in her seat.
What does it mean? The hanged man represents ultimate surrender.
I blinked. What? Casey elbowed me in the side.
Ultimate surrender, Teddy. Sounds kinky.
Now I did roll my eyes, and Olivia laughed heartily.
The ultimate surrender of the hanged man, she continued after a moment, is the surrender of self for others. Personal sacrifices made for the greater good, putting self-interests aside, or giving up goals in favor of that which he perceives to be higher causes.
She fixed me with a strong gaze.
You put the needs and wants of others first, always, and without complaint. Yes?
I sat back in the old wooden chair, not sure how the hell I was supposed to answer.
Yes, Casey said. Yes! That's Teddy, 100%!
She looked at me, her eyes soft and warm.
You've always been that way.
I shifted in my seat and turned to Olivia. So where does the guidance part come in?
The hangman looks content, she said. Note the calm expression on his face. Yet he is tethered to this tree, suspended, a life suspended.
She settled back in her chair.
You content yourself with the belief what you're doing is best for those around you. Yet your own dreams and goals suffer for it. You must choose a path. Finalize a decision that has been looming before you. Take action for your own sake, not for the sake of others, or remain forever suspended.
Casey nodded, as if she knew exactly what Olivia meant, and they both looked to me, expectantly. Yeah, okay, I muttered, just to get the reading over with.
Hell, who isn't facing major decisions in their life?
Who doesn't want to feel like they're selfless and always put others first? Olivia probably had a generalization memorized for every card, with a little ego boost thrown in. Granted, the hangman's meaning hit a little closer to home than I wanted to admit. Fine, I admitted it. Didn't make me a believer. As if she'd read my thoughts, Olivia returned the hangman to the deck and began to shuffle again, her expression smug and satisfied. She fanned the cards over the table in front of Casey.
Choose your card, sweetheart.
Casey bit her lip, her eyes scanning the cards, and finally chose one toward the middle of the deck and flipped it over. She sat back with a small gasp. My hands clenched into fists under the table, as my heart skipped a beat. On the card was a sketch of a skeleton using a scythe like a broom, sweeping up gold crowns and jewels. 8 was inscribed at the top. At the bottom,
Death,
Casey whispered. Olivia watched her closely.
It is not the card you think it is, my dear. No?
Casey's eyes were fixed on the sketch, her voice small.
Seems like it's exactly the card I think it is.
I leaned into her. We don't have to stay.
No, it's fine.
She looked at Olivia.
What does it mean?
The card of death is a harbinger of change, the psychic said. It is the closing of one door and the opening of another. Transition. You feel cast adrift, no? Trapped in an in-between state that has left you unsure of how to proceed. You cannot go back, and yet...
I can't go forward, Casey murmured. It's true. I'm stuck. No, my dear, Olivia said. You can't let go, but that is not the same as stuck. When you hold tightly to something behind you, you cannot move forward. The answer is to unclench your heart from the past. Close the door. Open a new chapter. Only then can you be free of the pain that haunts you.
The psychic paused for effect, and goddamn if I wasn't hanging on every word.
Acceptance, child, Olivia continued. That is the key. Accept that which has ended and let go so you can move on. So you may grow. So you may thrive. The light in your eyes, in your heart, has dimmed, but it is not put out. Let it roar once again.
A moment of breath-held silence. Then Casey exhaled and sat back, her eyes shining.
Thank you.
We left the shop after I slipped Olivia $20, $5 for each card, another 10 as a tip for how Casey hugged the woman, declaring how relieved she felt.
Wasn't that amazing? Casey said, her arm tucked in mine. I mean, you can chalk it all up to coincidence, but I felt some real truth there.
She looked up at me.
Did you?
A little, I said slowly. I'd felt hope as well as truth. Hope that the new chapter in Casey's life might include me in a meaningful way. So much for putting self-interests aside.
The big decision you've been putting off must mean the tattoo shop, right?
I shrugged. I guess.
How come you haven't bought your own place yet, Teddy?
I could have told her I was in the process of getting a business degree, but that would only make her feel like shit if she knew I'd missed my exams to be here. I shrugged again. Haven't found the right place yet. Casey frowned, then shivered a little, even though the night was warm.
I'm getting a little tired. I'd like to go home.
By the time we reached Casey's house, I was regretting tipping Olivia or even setting foot inside that psychic shop. Instead of lying down for a nap, Casey curled up on the chair in the living room, hugging the pillow tight and staring at nothing. I sat on the couch and reached over to tap her knee. You okay? She shook her head.
Not really.
Look, these so-called psychics.
She was exactly right,
Casey said. About what? She looked up at me, her eyes drowning in tears.
I can't let go of Jonah.
I sat back, nodded. Yeah, I hear you.
Sometimes when I'd come home drunk, she said, I'd fall into bed, and just before I passed out, I swear I could hear his voice, telling me to let go. And I'd wake up feeling so guilty, like maybe Jonah can't live in the stars until I let him go.
She plucked at a stray thread on her pillow, the tears dropping onto the orange fabric.
I always brushed it off as a dream. I'm not ready to let him go. And it doesn't feel like a choice anyway. It feels impossible.
I wished I knew how to talk to her, to make her feel better. But I was struck mute, my own grief trying to rise up and swamp me.
And how can I ever let go when there was still so much I didn't do? She demanded with sudden fire. Because I could have done more. I should have done more. I should have married him. Did he want that? A wedding? Or I could have had his baby, so he could know that a part of him would go on forever.
Casey.
I could have done it, she said fiercely. How can I let go when I didn't do enough?
Bullshit, I said.
Was Jonah ever not honest with you about what he wanted? Ever?
She sniffed and shrugged.
He wouldn't ask you for those things, I said. He wouldn't legally bind you for the sake of a stupid ceremony. He wouldn't ask you to have a kid and leave you to raise it on your own.
I know he wouldn't, but...
No regrets, right? Isn't that what you told him?
Casey nodded.
It is. And it's true. Except the regret I didn't do enough. The regret I couldn't...
Don't say it, I thought. Her eyes overflowed.
I couldn't save him.
Casey's hair fell over her face as she bent over, weeping. I couldn't save him. What I had felt every day of my life since Jonah got sick. Only I couldn't cry it out like she could. If I touched her grief with mine, I'd rage and howl and lose my fucking mind. Jonah, come back, you asshole. I sucked in a breath, used it to push the pain down. When I trusted my voice, I said, you did everything right. Everything. Casey lifted her head. When she brushed the hair from her eyes, the look within their depths was desperate. You made him happy, I said. Right at the time he needed it most. You made him happy. Quit worrying about what you didn't do, because what you did do was everything. Okay? She dragged the sleeve of her shirt across her face. Easier said than done. I could tell my words had helped to make her feel better. And making her feel better was as close to happy as I was ever going to get. That night, we watched 16 Candles with a pizza and soda. Casey sat beside me on the couch, half a cushion separating us, close enough to feel the warmth of her body. You're still flying back to Vegas on Sunday? She asked, as the credits rolled. That's the plan. Change of plan. I'm flying back with you. I looked over at her. Are you sure you're up for that? She sniffed a laugh. No, but I need to see your parents, and Oscar and Dina. Put those wrongs right. Isn't that one of the steps in recovery? Make amends? I guess, I said, staring at this woman who was so riddled with regret and shame and so oblivious to her own strength. That's part of the insidiousness of addiction, I thought. You remember the depth and blackness of the hole you were in, and not the strength it took to pull yourself out. I have a lot of apologizing to do, Casey said. I have to face Vegas at some